Hey, everybody, it's Chris and Rick Talk Guitars, and we wanted to continue our talk about Michigan guitar players since the last episode we did was about Wayne Kramer, and Chris is from Michigan, for God's sake, so he's got a tie-in. So we want to talk about Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter, two session dudes from the 70s, killer guitar players. They played on tons of stuff. There's a soft spot we have for session guys. You know, Chris and I love Tasty players and kind of the unsung heroes. They're starting to get their due now because more people are finding out about session players. But in the old days, they didn't get credits, or, you know, in the early days, they didn't get to go out and tour with bands. They just stayed in the studio and did stuff. It was probably rewarding work and they dug it. But as time went on, I think it's cool that certain session people got to actually tour with bands, you know, be more of a player in a band context with some of these artists. So, and in terms of Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter, they played with, you know, you name it, Alice Cooper, Lou Reed, Aerosmith, all kinds of people. So what do you think, Chris? Talk to me, baby.
Yeah. Those guys, they were two guitar players that I really didn't know I knew, but I did know. I was listening to them for years and I didn't even realize it. And then probably in the late 70s, I've read an article somewhere and I learned about them. And when Kiss Destroyer came out, there was a couple of songs on there that I thought, this doesn't sound like Kiss. This doesn't sound like Ace Frehley's guitar. It was really melodic and kind of like intricate parts, and there was harmony and stuff. And come to find out, it was those guys. They got pulled in a lot of times from the producer, Bob Ezrin. Bob Ezrin. So he'd have them come in sometimes for sessions where the song just wasn't coming together or gelling in a way. The two songs on Destroyer, I think it's Flaming Youth and Shout It Out Loud. And I think Steve Hunter played acoustic on Beth. So I pointed these out sometime in the early 80s to people, and they get pissed when you say this. On Aerosmith, Get Your Wings. They were on, I think it's Steve Hunter is the intro to Train Kept a Rolling, and at the later solo section, it's either both of them or Dick Wagner. Probably both of them. They do a lot of harmony stuff together. And also Same Old Song and Dance. That is, I think it's Steve Hunter.
I love it.
And or Dick Wagner. They played a lot together for a lot of stuff. And they were studio guys. They worked on a lot of records, but they also got to tour a lot. That they talk, you know, very, very fondly of the Alice Cooper tours that they did. Yeah. And they love the Lou Reed that they did. And that's kind of like one of my favorite guitar record, Rock and Roll Animal.
I love that record.
It's just totally, totally killer. Double guitar, Phase 90, Les Paul Jr. Rock and Roll. So they did quite a bit of touring in the late 70s. And their career, they were in kind of an unfortunate situation. They kind of got edged out when, at the end of like the blues rock kind of thing, when, you know, the Shredders came in with, you know, Van Halen and all that.
Right.
And so they like found themselves kind of not working a lot. And I think it was Steve Hunter who said one time, it must have been like in the late 80s or something, he was in a Tower record store with $20 in his pocket. He had to buy a CD because he was going to play on a record and he had to learn the song. And he bought a CD. He said he was spending his last $20. This is the guy that's all over, you know, Welcome to My Nightmare.
Oh my God.
You know, all these records. So it's a pretty interesting story. I know that Dick Wagner wrote a book that I got to get. I haven't gotten it and read it. I would love to read all the inside stories. You know, everybody from, you know, like Aerosmith. I mean, the interesting part about the Aerosmith deal is I read an article with Brad Whitford where he was talking about that record. Uh-huh. And he said him and Joe Perry were super bummed about that. But they said after they thought about it, they took it as a great example of rock and roll guitar. And they kind of studied that. And that's great because those two guitarists, Hunter and Wagner, are probably responsible for, you know, a lot of toys in the attic, because those two in Aerosmith probably said, fuck this isn't going to happen again. We're going to play all of our solos from here on out. Those are two really good guitar players too, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting.
But where did they both meet for the first time? Did they meet like in the Aerosmith sessions? Do you know? Or
No, they met
somewhere. Because they became really friendly.
They knew each other. I mean, Steve Hunter was in Mitch Ryder in the Detroit Wheels.
Oh, that's
he was
right.
a guitar player
that's
in that
right.
band. And Dick Wagner played in a band called The Frost. I have one of their records here. And so I think they met each other maybe around, I don't recall, but I think the first thing they worked on together was like, I think it was some of the Alice Cooper stuff, I believe. Ghouls Out. I think he was on that record. And then what was after that? Muscle of Love, I think it was. And then Steve Hunter came in. Steve Hunter and Dick Wagner are on Billion Dollar Babies. Yeah. And that's got a lot. And I didn't know about that because one of my first bands I was really into was Alice Cooper.
That's
and
awesome.
So I listened to those guitar players a lot because I had those records. And then they have a lot of love for the Lou Reed live stuff they did. There were two records that they did live. But also, I really love the record that they did with Lou Reed, the first one they did with him, which was Berlin. It was a record that was like just got shit on, critically shit on. People just didn't get it. It was too out there for the time. And it's a brilliant record. I have it. I love it. But they were on that. And Lou Reed took so much shit for that record that he said, fuck it. I'm just going to go on. And I just want to play rock and roll, like loud rock and roll.
I love it.
So he had those guys. Those guys arranged all those songs.
Yeah.
They kind of worked it out, like the big Sweet Jane solo and that stuff. So they went out and they had a blast. They loved it. But that tour, they got like the crowd loved those two guys. And it started to get a little bit annoying for Lou Reed.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Like,
yeah.
Like they were kind of too out front. So he kind of told them to dial it back. And Lou Reed always didn't speak very highly of that record or that time. He wasn't really into it. And I loved his other records too, but I loved them both. There was a time when Rock and Roll Animal didn't click with me, probably when I was first into Lou Reed in the 80s, when I got into him, because I was really into this like thing where, you know, anti-wank, you know, you don't do long solos and things like that. And that's so like out there, like kind of the blues noodles at times. But it's pretty incredible. It's lyrical. It's like, it's very musical. There's like a lot of interlocking parts. It's hard. They play very much kind of almost the same. It's hard to tell them apart sometimes, but you do, once you dig in and you find out who's who on which side they are on the stereo spectrum, you can kind of pick out their little characteristics. But, you know, I loved it. I loved it both. I mean, I play that record all the time, and I also play Berlin and, you know, Blue Mask and anything else I can get my hands on. So.
Yeah, well, the thing I dug about it, too, is just the friendship that was forged between the two guys. You know, I mean, any other guys, egos might have gotten in the way or, you know what I mean? But some reason, they clicked together. They played together well. They gave each other space, which I thought was really, really cool. And just reading interviews with both of them, they have the utmost respect for each other and love. And yeah, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the Lou Reed thing, because I was going to mention that, which I thought was really funny that, you know, I think it was Wagner that put the band together for Reed. And he was saying like they played these shows and people were really getting into the guitar stuff, and Lou Reed was getting kind of pissed off, and had to have the talk with the guys. But it's funny, too, because I remember also Lou Reed in interviews just saying how much he loved rock and roll and wanted to basically be a rock and roll star, right? Like, I want to be.
He was.
And so to me, I think that album and those guys were kind of the epitome of his, of that manifestation of Lou Reed, right? Kind of, I think. But
have you listened to Berlin at all?
Not in a long time.
You should give that one a whirl. It's a commitment to get into it, but I love it. It's probably the most depressing record ever made.
I love it.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And that's the other thing about those two that it's really worth pointing out, is they were very good at writing and arranging. I mean, I think it was Dick Wagner, I think, wrote Only Women Bleed, a good part of that, and some other like big songs. And they were really, really good at arranging and just getting like interlocking parts and stuff like that. Yeah, in Alice Cooper, after Alice Cooper, the Alice Cooper band broke up and it became solo Alice Cooper. Uh-huh. Dick Wagner was on all of like the next five records. They would all go and write together. So he was a big part of the writing process for all those. So it had been like, you know, Welcome to My Nightmare. And what was the one? Alice Cooper Goes to Hell, Lace and Whiskey, and, you know, all that era. And they finally got to, you know, having to be pulled back a little bit in the Lou Reed band.
Yeah.
They had to have millions of great guitar battles and stuff in the Alice Cooper thing, because it was just all showmanship. Yep. So, you know, they would wear top hats and capes and all that shit.
I was going to say, I watched the video of that, and it's so fun to watch. They both have the garb on, the top hats and the capes and stuff, and they're just, you know, shredding. I think Wagner's playing a BC Rich.
They were
one of the
most earliest users of the BC Riches. Yeah. They have a lot of good things to say about those early ones.
Yeah. And Hunter was playing a cool TV yellow special, double cut special. Mm-hmm. And they were both Marshalls. You know, they played through Marshalls and the Phase 90s and all that stuff. And it's just cool to hear them talk about that stuff so fondly, because Wagner, he talked about how cool it was to write with Alice Cooper. Like, you know, Alice would fly him to Hawaii and they'd spend a week writing songs and doing that stuff. So, I mean, Alice totally respected him and Hunter as not only guitar players, but just integral parts of his whole creative process, which I thought was super cool for them to experience that. Yeah. But another thing I think that's so cool in the evolution of session people is the fact that these guys weren't relegated to the studios, but they got to get out and be band members in people's bands and do some touring and do some of that other stuff. Like, you know, some of the earlier era studio musicians may not have gotten to experience, but
right.
I think that's so cool. I really dug that about these guys.
All got to be part of the 70s rock and roll excess.
Totally.
And then they got to watch it all go away. First, like, it probably took a little bit of hits during punk rock. When punk rock came up, they were probably like, you know, these guys are, you know, dinosaurs or whatever. So they took a hit there. And then after, like, the Van Halen thing, it was over. That's pretty much, I mean, they made music their entire lives. So I think Dick Wagner died in, I think, 2014 or something. And I believe Steve Hunter's still alive.
He is still alive, yeah. Right. I think he's got a YouTube channel. That is interesting to talk about too, is the paradigm shift in guitar styles and things like that. I wonder if there are other session people that were more chameleon-like that could withstand like paradigm shifts, or if it was just like, if it's just inevitable that you kind of spend your time in a certain era and then sure enough, you know, you fall out of favor. I don't know. Well, another interesting thing to me too is like, were these guys mentioned in liner notes at all or just sparsely? Yeah.
And I don't remember if that, I don't think that was due to contractual things. It was just like, kind of like, you know, I really don't know the reason for that, but they weren't on any of those records. I mean, I think if you go to Wikipedia, I think they get their credits where they play, but maybe not. It seems like last time I was looking up Dick Wagner, there was one record. Or maybe it's Steve Hunter. There was one record that they were definitely on that's not on their list. So yeah, it was like shrouded in mystery in the 70s and 80s. And it also caused a lot of, I mean, I had a friend, it would have been like 1980, and he was way, way into Aerosmith. And I had learned that about, you know, and I'm like, you know that blah, blah, blah guitar. So he's like, no, he wanted to fight.
It's, oh my, like, God.
You don't say that about Aerosmith. I was like, I like Aerosmith. That's one thing that's about people today that I don't know. Aerosmith is one of those bands that it's really easy for anybody born in the last like 20 years or so not to realize what an amazing band that was, because they've sucked for so long. I mean, they don't suck. I mean, I saw a video from recently where they were doing something off Rocks and it was amazing. It was like, oh my God, they can really play it, but they just didn't make any good records.
Yeah, I know
after
what you
that,
mean.
Or, you know, and, but I mean, they made records that made the money, but that's cool. But, you know, I went back on a little Aerosmith revisit and I was just amazed at like what a good run of records they had for like just fantastic, like songwriting and playing and stuff.
Yeah. So I agree totally.
But, you know, for a lot of people, they were like just this band that played at the Super Bowl or something, just like these old, old people. I actually saw a review on some site about Aerosmith and was talking about, I think it was the Toys in the Attic record. And they reviewed it like, who are these old fuckers trying to play? I mean, they were in their 20s when they made that record.
Oh, my God. That's like hilarious. Because when I was growing up, I mean, I would read the album and go, oh, so-and-so courtesy of Polygram Records or so-and-so courtesy of Epic Records. And I would know that they were, you know, they were brought in for this session, but I didn't really think deeper about like all the session people out there that are on these records that are doing the stuff that most of us probably didn't even know, you know, and we got invested in these bands. And then somebody like you walk up and go, hey, did you know so-and-so? It's like, what? You know, you probably shattered the guy's world.
Get the fuck out of here.
Exactly.
I'll kill you.
But I think that's fascinating because when you and I were growing up, I mean, there was more of a shroud around that whole process in terms of like, you know, who was playing on these records. Did you know did you sense that when you were reading liner notes and stuff or did you?
Oh, yeah. I was way into that shit. I mean, I write every single word on every record, you know.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think of anybody that showed up on other records. Like, I knew that David Bowie was on Mott the Hoople's All the Young Dudes and Mick Ronson, but for the most part everything was just, you know, as a kid you're like a collector and everything's so band centric, it's just like they become this whole unit. But I was always into stuff like that, but I didn't know about those guys, but I'd heard their songs so many times.
I mean, Well, I was so naive. I just thought the band, they were all best friends. They all slept in the same house in bunk beds and they got along and they, you know what I mean? I mean, I was so naive. And then, yeah, as you get older, you start to realize that they hate each other and they've done this for 20 years and they did it for 20 years prior to their first album, you know? So again, like the session thing aspect of it to me, as I got older, became so fascinating because not only Wagner and Hunter, but you know, you and I are fond of so many session players. We've become to know over time. I think it's a whole cool thing that finally they're getting their due just because, you know, it's become known and people want to know about it. And I think that's cool. I wonder if they feel a sense of pride or gratitude, kind of getting some recognition for that.
I'm sure they do. I think it was Steve Hunter I read somewhere where somebody, like, he was in a record store or something and somebody like recognized him. And he was really like, it made him feel really good. It was
That's
like,
so cool.
You know, probably in the 90s or something like that. So yeah, they probably did. There's a movie. It's kind of a low budget thing. I think it's called Rock and Roll Animals, that it's got a lot of Alice Cooper in it and those guys talking about that time frame. And I saw it and I just kind of, when we were talking about this, I kind of Googled it, but I couldn't find it. I found like bits of it on YouTube, but it's worth looking into if you can find that. Rock and Roll Animals.
Yeah. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, but and I'm gonna get the Wagner's book too. I gotta get Wayne Kramer's book. I gotta get a bunch of rock books.
Oh man,
I need to find out more dirt and tell people that their favorite guitar
crush their dreams.
Yeah, exactly.
That's your job, Chris. Crush their dreams. I'm glad you, because I mean, I remember hearing Dick Wagner's name, but I didn't know much about Steve Hunter until I think you kind of clued me into that initially, and gave me the kind of the light that went on about these guys, which was cool. And yeah, because I think like your friend, I don't think I knew that they had played on those songs for Aerosmith. And so, but I think, and like you say, I think, I wonder how many artists too are as magnanimous as Whitford in terms of, you know, initially I'm sure it's kind of the phases of grieving or something, or, you know, first you're shocked and pissed and then
kicking rocks.
Yeah. Kicking rocks. But I think that's such a cool idea that A, he saw that, yeah, I saw they're great guitar players and they added something to it. And then B, it lit a fire under my butt to be a better guitar player.
Yeah.
I wonder if that kind of happened.
Yeah. Forget Whitford's quote. He had a really good quote. He had a really good quote about that. Like, just like, it was just a really good schooling on rock and roll guitar for me. I learned a lot from that. So I must say, and this, the way that happened on the Aerosmith record is they were in the same studio, I think, recording, and Jack Douglas, who was producing Aerosmith, saw, I think it was Steve Hunter in the hallway, and said, "Do you want to play some guitar?" Because they were having trouble getting the vision for the song, to getting the parts right. Like, I guess Perry and Whitford were having runs at it, and it just wasn't really clicking. And he came in and I think he took like two passes or three passes or something. And that's what you hear on the record. So
that's another interesting thing that I'm fascinated by about session people is the red light fever thing, right? Like, cause I can have that in the studio where I feel pressure. Like if I'm not on and it's like, shit, okay, I'm not going to get this part tonight. Whereas, you know, probably people like Hunter and Wagner and Hal Blaine, all these guys are just like, yeah, I'll do it. And I'll do it the first take and I'll kick, you know, I think there's just that part of a person's makeup that is conducive for them to be a session person so that they can, you know, and that's why they're so valued by producers and stuff too. So it's like, I can call this guy and I know he can come in and just nail it, you know?
Right. That red light fever thing. The first time ever I experienced it was just recently, and it sucks. It's just like, you get in your own head, you can't get out of it. And that's terrible, but I'll definitely not work on that because it's really annoying. Cause I love recording. Recording is really like one of the reasons why I play music. So it sucks to get in that mode where you're just feeling like, oh, I got to get this time. The clock's rolling. And
I know. And
you feel weird. You just don't feel relaxed. Like,
exactly.
I don't know, but just something to work on. I mean, something to think about. We should do a whole episode on red light fever. And
we should.
We should get some doctors in and like some really talk about it to get some support. We start a support group.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I'm glad we talked about these guys. I want to do more about session guys. There's Dean Parks. There's other guys. I think we could talk about those guys too, because they did stuff with different bands like Bread and different cats. So I think this might be kind of an ongoing thing that we talk about session people, because they fascinate me. I love it. Waddy Wachtel and, you know, Lee Sklar, they're part of another, and they're all there were different groups of session people throughout the eras too that kind of became. Right. Yeah.
You mentioned the Wrecking Crew, and then it was like the family.
Immediate family.
I wonder if people have a harder time in more recent years after the LP era, when it's, you know, that all the print on the records either went away or it's really small.
I mean, we
used to have a lot more to read. So maybe people aren't into it as much as they were.
Well, and there aren't even liner notes anymore, like on the streaming services. They don't have liner notes. They'll have shit about the band, but I actually sent something to Spotify saying, hey, because I put together a mock-up of like putting liner notes into the stuff, and they gave me some like, you know, pat, you know, BS answer or something. But I miss liner notes, and because I totally dug that. Like I was saying before, I loved seeing like, oh, so-and-so, you know, courtesy of so, you know, that, so they brought in a drummer or a conga player or a guitarist or whatever to play on that session, and you could see it. So they got a little love on the album, and then you got more insights, and you could go check that person out too if they did solo stuff or on other people's records. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, that seems like something that the internet would be good for.
Right. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, I'll figure it out this weekend.
Well, as always, thanks for listening, people. We're proud members of the Ruinous Media Network, and Chris and I really enjoy doing this. So thanks for listening. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube now, too, so check that out. And we're going to start dabbling in other things. So what else do you got, Chris?
No, I think you covered it. That was pretty good.
Thanks, man.
You should record that.
All right. Until next time, people.
See ya.